Well, we come to the last message in Paul's letter to Titus, so please come with me to Titus chapter 3 and verses 9 to 15. Now, this summer some of you are doing GCSEs and A-levels, and for each subject, if you haven't already done so, you'll soon be finishing the syllabus. And what then? Well, then comes the revision. And what's a good revision technique? Well, it's to gather up all that you've learnt and to sum it up in a few pithy expressions or bullet points. Now, don't forget. Some of us remember taking our driving test. Some of us remember taking our driving test more than once. And especially that lesson before, where all that we've learnt over those weeks is pressed into that hour. And three-point turns and reversing round a corner and emergency stop. Don't forget. So exams, driving tests, and Paul's closing words. Christian friends, what's been going on these last few weeks? We've been studying this letter, haven't we? Paul's letter to Titus, to the churches on Crete. And we've had three chapters straightening out the churches. Three chapters on closing that gap between the talk and the walk. Three chapters spelling out in practical everyday terms what it means to live the godly life. And three chapters on our motives for doing so. And why, given our wicked former lives, it's realistic to insist upon Christlikeness now. And if in those three chapters, the link between what we believe and how we behave has been reinforced, there have also been warnings about false beliefs and the lifestyles which they produce. So we've had three chapters, haven't we? And now as we look at chapter 3, verses 9 to 15, it's the revision. It's the lesson before the test. It's Paul's final words before he leaves the room. And he says, now don't forget. So please have those verses in front of you. And we just have 2 points this morning. Point number one, what to avoid. Verse 9, but avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. Reject a devise of man after the first and second admonition, knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. As we've seen, these churches on Crete, they've been troubled by false teachers, deceivers, imposters. That's why Paul says to Titus chapter 1 verse 5, the first thing you need to do in every city, in every local church, is to appoint elders. Why? Well, they're shepherds. And they're shepherds who will be able to protect the sheep from these ravenous wolves who are out there, who are looking to do just one thing, rip the flock apart. Now, of course, they come in sheep's clothing. And to the unwary believer, they look just like a believer. They look just like another sheep. But says Paul, you can spot who they are. Just look at chapter 1 for a moment, a little bit of revision. Do these people like authority? Do they like elders with an open Bible? No. Verse 10, for there are many insubordinate. Do they keep quiet? No, they have a great deal to say, verse 10 of chapter 1. They're idle talkers. And when they speak, they say, take my word for it. Take me at face value. Take me on my estimation of myself. Because, verse 10, they are deceivers. They're appearing to be something which they are not. Oh, but they know their Bibles, or at least some parts of the Bible, chapter and verse, and they sound so plausible, so biblical. For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision. Here were these Jews who are genned up on the Old Testament law. And these people, they like to operate outside the structures and meetings of the church, verse 11, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not. And of course, they're not bothered about the sheep. All they're bothered about is themselves, and the sheep are a means to advance themselves. They're in it, verse 11, for dishonest gain. And perhaps the most dangerous thing about these people, they know just where you're itching, and therefore where to scratch. The instinct of the Cretans was to take the course of least resistance. The most gain for the least pain. We're told about them, chapter 1, verse 12. One of them, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. They'll always take the easiest way. That's in their nature. It's in their instinct, in their DNA. And it seems, chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, these false teachers, they knew exactly where to scratch these believers because they promised them a short cut to holiness. You can have all the blessings of the Christian life with none of the cost. No need to take up your cross, deny yourself. Well, says Paul now in chapter 3, in his closing words, don't forget, avoid these people and avoid their teachings. Avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. Now, it's very difficult to pin down exactly what these people were teaching. So think of their teachings as, well, as rather like clouds floating by. And here are these Cretan believers, and they're looking up. It's a very clear day, but there's some clouds in the sky, and they're looking up at these clouds floating by. And what do they see? Well, they look up, they see the clouds are so high. Oh yes, the high doctrines of these false teachers. Chapter 1, verse 16, they profess to know God in a way, of course, in which you don't know God. And these creatures are saying, oh, do you think you could teach us? Chapter 3, verse 9, genealogies. Oh, you just thought that was just a long list of names in the Old Testament, didn't you? But behind the names, there are patterns, insights, sacred, special, secret meanings. Oh, do you think you could teach me? And if the clouds are high, they're also big. Verse 9, questions about the law. Oh, yes, very important. And I see that Paul has neglected to tell you about these things. Oh, there's obviously a lack in your understanding. Questions about the law. We need to discuss this. We need to talk about this. Oh, do you think you could teach me? High clouds, big clouds. And they come in so many different shapes. Chapter 1, verse 14, Jewish fables. Stories. Everyone loves a story, don't they? Especially if wrapped up inside the story, there's some sacred knowledge. Tell me more. High clouds, big clouds, lots of clouds of different shapes, and beautiful clouds. Or maybe some are dark, threatening clouds. Either way, these young believers, they just can't take their eyes off them. Chapter 1, verse 14, their commandments. Now, of course, as Paul goes on to say, they're commandments of men. But to impressionable young believers, if the one who's telling you seems so much more mature and experienced than you are, well, who am I to disagree with these commandments? Do you see? It's difficult to pin down, is it? But these teachings, they're like high, big, multi-shaped, important-looking clouds. But of course, just like a cloud, you can't get hold of them. There's nothing there. There's no substance to them. There's nothing to hold on to. For all the appearance of spirituality which these teachings have, in reality, they're empty, vacuous, floating clouds. And you know that, says Paul, by the life which these teachings produce. Now, Christian friends, again and again in this letter, Paul has drawn out the link, hasn't he? He says, what you believe will determine how you behave. You do what you do because you believe a certain thing. So did you, when we were reading, did you hear Paul's deliberate contrast he makes between verses 8 and 9? This is what he says in verse 8. He says, this is a faithful saying, and these things I want you to affirm constantly, that those who have believed in God should be careful to maintain good works. These things are good and profitable to men. But avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. So verse 8, apostolic teaching is what? It's good and profitable for all. But verse 9, false teaching is what? It's unprofitable and useless. Verse 8, apostolic teaching leads to a life of good works. Verse 9, false teaching leads to disputes, contentions, strivings. Verse 8, apostolic teaching produces godly churches. And verse 9, false teaching produces churches riven by strife and arguments and divisions. These false teachings may be difficult to pin down, because at the end of the day, they're without substance. But there is no doubt about the trouble and the heartache which these teachings produce. So Titus, what must you do when you meet these teachings? Very simple. Verse 9, avoid them. Don't dignify them by getting into a discussion about them. Don't legitimize them by opening your Bible and reasoning things through. Avoid them. And the word avoid is very strong. You're walking down the street and you see someone that you're trying to avoid. What do you do? What have you done? Cross the road? Pretend you haven't seen them? Give them a wide berth? They're all avoidance strategies, aren't they? But the word Paul uses here means that you stop, you turn round, and you walk the other way. Titus, don't even begin to get involved. Just turn round, walk away. Now, why is Paul so dismissive of these false teachings? When false teaching comes to the Galatian churches, Paul writes a letter demolishing the heresy line by line. So why doesn't he do it here? And the simple answer is because here, these false teachings, they lack any clarity or cohesion or substance. That Galatian heresy was a wrong reading of the Old Testament. And so Paul opens the Old Testament scriptures and he puts things right. But these teachings are just stupid, uneducated, foolish. Avoid foolish disputes. Avoid stupid disputes. That's what he's saying. Because if you get involved in these things, you start arguing about these teachings, all it will become is a strife of words. Yes? There may be many good and reasonable discussions to have about the moon. But it's not worth getting involved in a discussion about whether or not the moon is made of cheese. It's a stupid discussion, isn't it? Do you see? These teachings are not like rock into which you can drill holes and then you can ram in the dynamite of the gospel and then you can press the plunger and boom, and the false teaching's blown to smithereens. They're not like that. They're not made of rock. They're like those clouds floating by. And you try and catch them and there's nothing to them. There's no substance to them. They're just words. That's why when you try and argue about them, you're just arguing about words. And when you start arguing about words, what do you get? You get arguments, quarrels, contentions, strivings. And when you try and unwrap it, what are we really arguing about? Well, there's nothing there. So Titus, don't even begin. Just dismiss them, avoid them, walk away from them. That's what he's saying. There are some false teachings which are, you have to deal with them. You have to say, drill holes in them and put the gospel in and blow them apart. But other false teachings are just fantastical nonsense. So just walk away from them. This week the news agency Reuters reported on a new insight onto those events at Sinai when God came down and met with Moses and the children of Israel. Now, according to a new study by psychology professor Benny Shannon, that thunder, the lightning, the blast of the trumpet, God coming down. What were those things? Well, he says they were the imaginings of a people high on hallucinogenic drugs. Now, do I believe that? No. Is it worth getting into an argument about it? No. We're not even on the same planet, are we? Avoid foolish disputes. Some professing Christians, they had a number of contentious views about baptism, the Lord's table, Bible translations. They were very certain about some things which were commandments, but actually when you looked at them, it just seemed to be like commandments of men. And they had some very strong views about Christmas, which is fair enough. But they said that Santa was an anagram of Satan. Well, it is. But so what? Now, we don't mind getting out a Bible, sitting down, discussing how Christians should respond to Christmas. And maybe we'll come to different conclusions and different convictions. And we'll respect one another, and we have and we do. But getting into a debate at the level of Santa and Satan is simply likely to end up with a strife of words. Just one big heated argument which does no one any good, which doesn't promote godliness, but contention. And it ends up with an us and them mentality. And before long you get a divided church. In fact, I know of an evangelical church, not so long ago, about 20 members, and that church is now split into two because they couldn't agree whether or not Christmas was an evangelistic opportunity. Now, somewhere along the line, someone should have just walked away, shouldn't they? The dispute, what has it done? Has it promoted unity? Has it advanced the gospel? Has it led to godly, holy lives pulsating with good works? All it has done is simply promote division. Avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. Now, Christian friends, we're not afraid of contention. And there are some times when we're happy to stride out onto the battlefield and to plant the blood-red standard of Jesus Christ and to earnestly contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. We're not afraid to contend. We're not afraid to shatter the unity sometimes when the gospel itself is at stake. But the gospel isn't at stake. These are strifes of words. So, Christian friends, we do thank God for books, don't we? And for recorded sermons and websites and discussion boards and all those other things that we have access to. But Christian friend, are you being careful? There are all sorts of pseudo-Christian, pseudo-spiritual teachings out there. They sound really good. They really do. They're those big, high, beautiful, multi-shaped clouds floating by. And people will say these things are really important. Ah, but you won't hear them at your church. And you won't hear them in your church because your church is compromised. That's why you won't hear them there. But we'll tell you about them. Christian friends, be so very, very careful. The effect of these things is to simply draw us into stupid arguments, into a them and us mentality. And far from promoting godliness and good works, what does it promote? We're told they are unprofitable and useless. So avoid them. It's quite able to preach on it, quite what we're saying, isn't it? Because you can't get hold of these things. But it's what they do. Okay. But, says Paul, verses 10 and 11, it's not enough simply to avoid the false teachings. You've got to deal with those who peddle them, haven't you? And they're easy to spot. Because wherever these people go, they cause division. Verse 10, reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition. A divisive man, listen carefully. You may just spot one day. A divisive man, what do? Well, they major on minors. They argue about words. Sometimes it's very difficult to pin down exactly what they're saying. And they keep their distance from brothers and sisters who disagree. and they have clear convictions where the Bible hasn't spoken clearly. So it's commandments of men, isn't it? And they complain about churches. They've always got a downer on the churches. And they create a them and us mentality. And they always seem to be found around young believers and malcontents. Titus is not enough to avoid these teachings. You've got to deal with those who spread them. Reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition, knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. Now, Paul is very gentle, because he gives space for the fact that there may be some genuine Christians who've got caught up in all of this. So when you meet one of these people, Titus, don't assume that they're a lost cause. First of all, admonish them. In the meekness and gentleness of Christ, some straight talking from an open Bible which seeks to warn and correct. The man's got to be confronted. You've got to say, brother, no more. Well, who's to do it? Well, Titus is to do it. And those who he's appointed in the churches, the elders. Well, what if he doesn't listen? There's no change of heart. Well, says Paul, admonish him the second time. And it seems like that Paul's referring to Matthew chapter 18 and verse 17. If he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him become to you like a heathen or a tax collector. So the elders bring the matter to the church. It's the second admonition. But if the man still doesn't heed, if there's still no repentance, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. If he won't listen to an open Bible, if he won't, if he treats the people of God with contempt, he does not listen to the church, then he obviously doesn't belong with them. He's twisted, he's sinning, and you don't even have to make a pronouncement on him, says Paul. By his own actions, he's condemned, knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. So avoid the teachings, don't get caught up in them, but you'll have to deal with those who are propagating them. Give them space. Some Christians may have got caught up in all of this, but if they're not listening, then they show they have no part of Christ and no part of his church. So after the second admonition, you reject them. You put them out of the church. Christian friends, false teachings. Where do they come from? Divisive men who break the unity of churches and leave churches with infighting. Who sent them? Who are they serving? Then you'll understand why there are teachings to avoid and men to reject. Point number two. We talked about what to avoid, what to pursue. Verse 12. When I send Artemas to you, or Tychicus, be diligent to come to me at Nicopolis, for I have decided to spend the winter there. Paul's giving Titus an update. Titus has been left in Crete, straightening out the churches. But Titus, when your replacement comes, now I don't know who it's going to be, it might be Artemas, it might be Tychicus, I'm not sure yet. But when they come, I want you to rendezvous with me at Nicopolis, because I'm planning to spend the winter there. And verse 13, send Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their journey with haste, that they may lack nothing. Did Zenas and Apollos, did they bring this letter to Titus? We don't know, possibly. What is certain is, Titus, you're to speed them on their journey by providing for their necessities, for their needs, maybe it's food, maybe it's clothing, maybe it's money, that they may lack nothing. And now, with that thought in our minds of Titus' opportunity to do these two people good, cue verse 14. And let our people also learn to maintain good works, to meet urgent needs, that they may not be unfruitful. And there it is again. It's your revision notes. Good works. How many times has Paul mentioned good works in this letter? Chapter 1, verse 8, talking about elders. A lover of what is good. Chapter 1, verse 16. The false teachers profess to know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. Chapter 2, verse 3. That the older women be teachers of good things. chapter 2, verse 7. In all things, Titus, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. Chapter 2, verse 14. Who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. Chapter 3, verse 1. To be ready for every good work. Chapter 3, verse 8. This is a faithful saying, and these things I want you to affirm constantly, that those who have believed in God should be careful to maintain good works. Seven times he says it, and now an eighth, as he's walking out the door. One last thing. And let our people also learn to maintain good works. It's almost a repetition, isn't it, of the words in verse 8. Be careful to maintain good works. Learn to maintain good works. I think Paul's making a point. So before he goes out that door, one last time. Now don't forget, the people of God, verse 14, must learn to devote themselves to a life of good works. So Christian friend, have you got the message? Let's drive it home one more time, says the apostle. Not afraid to repeat himself. Verse 14, and let our people also learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs, that they may not be unfruitful. That they may not be unfruitful. Christian friend, fruitfulness. The parable of the talents. You might want to turn to it. It's Matthew 25. Christian friend, to each of us, Christ has entrusted talents. What are they? They're the hours of my day, the strength in my body, the gifts in my keeping, the opportunities to do good, the work of the kingdom. And says Jesus, whether I've given you 5, 2, or 1 talent, get trading. Work hard, work faithfully, work urgently, work now. Don't be unfruitful. And in the parable, which is the one that's unfruitful? He's the one who buries his talent in the ground. Chapter 25, verse 24. It's judgment day. And he who had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. He's kept it safe, hasn't spent it, hasn't squandered it. He's apparently done nothing wrong. But that's just it, isn't it? He's done nothing. He's unfruitful. And because of what he fails to do, because of an absence of good works, because he is unfruitful, what is he called? Verse 26, he's called wicked and lazy. Verse 30, he's called unprofitable. That's why Paul says that they may not be unfruitful. Christian friends, do you see how seriously Christ views sins of omission? An absence of good works. It's not good works that saved us, of course not. But it is the evidence that we are saved. Christ takes them... Can't find a word which... More seriously, perhaps, than we could ever conceive. Do you take them seriously? Stay in Matthew 25. It's judgment day. Look at verses 41 to 46. Here are people who call Jesus Lord. They say, well, we're believers. But what is it about them? They are unfruitful. And they're cast out. Why are they cast out? We're not bad people. Verse 41, then he will say to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you didn't take me in. Naked and you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison and you didn't visit me. Then they will answer him saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them saying, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Do you see? Those who are God's people, who Paul calls here our people, what is it about them? They bear good fruit. They're not unfruitful. In fact, they're so taken up with their Lord that their love and care flourishes towards his people. And their love for Christ is revealed in 1,000 practical expressions of love towards his people and beyond. But wicked and lazy servants, when they see the need, what do? Well, they don't do anything. Surely I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me, that they may not be unfruitful, says the apostle. Paul's driving the message home, isn't he, Christian friends? Good works, fruitfulness. Fruitfulness. Have we got the message? Are you closing that gap? But what is it that stops us from being fruitful? Look again at verse 14. Now, people also learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs, that they may not be unfruitful. To meet urgent needs. Where do we go wrong? It's the pause, isn't it? It's the pause between seeing the urgent need and then doing something about it. Yep, we're sincere, we want to help, we feel moved. We want to be fruitful, but somehow we never get round to it. Christian friend, is that you? When I look back on my days and my weeks and my months, the regrets so often come on the heels of lost and missed opportunities. You see the pressing need, but nothing happens. Derek Sewell was talking about the work of the gospel in Covent Garden and beyond. Now, you don't need me to tell you about London house prices and, humanly speaking, the urgent need which they had in Covent Garden for permanent accommodation. Humanly speaking, that was beyond reach. But then there was a city businessman, a believer, and he received a six-figure bonus that year. So what did he do? He gave it to the work so they could buy a house in Covent Garden. There wasn't just an urgent need. This man responded to it urgently. Had he delayed, he may well have changed his mind. He may well have had second thoughts. Maybe it would be better to plough it back into building bigger barns. Christian friends, that's why Paul says to meet urgent needs, because he knows what stops us so often from doing the good works is the pause. We see the urgent need, but we don't respond to it with the same urgency. And it's fatal, isn't it? There's an opportunity for doing good, but because I fail to respond to it urgently, what happens? That window of opportunity closes, and I now can't do anything. The moment has passed. This week, a brother rang me about hymn books and what did I think of new Christian hymns. I think he had changed in the hymn books, and we talked about what was in the hymn book and what wasn't in the hymn book. Well, maybe we ought to have this song in our hymn book. It's by Elvis. I shan't sing it, but it's called Always on My Mind. Maybe we should sing this. Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind. Should we sing that? Does it accurately reflect how we go about meeting one another's needs? Little things I should have said and done, but you were on my mind. Christian friends, no excuses, not even holy ones. Have you got the message? Let's bear fruit, says Paul. And when you see the opportunity, don't delay. Take it. Do it there and then. Meet urgent needs. But one last thing, as he says, and let our people also learn to maintain, devote themselves to good works. So let's make it practical. Let's make it here and now. Is there anything I can do today? In this coming week? That list in Matthew 25. Christ also speaks to the people of God. He says, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Anything there you can do this week? Or maybe you can extend that principle to other areas. Good works. Anything you can do? Babysitting? Someone need their lawn mowed or gardening? Washing a car, cleaning someone's shoes, doing their ironing, shopping, maybe just sending a text, picking up the phone, asking how somebody is, writing a letter. Someone received just a four-line letter, but it so encouraged them that they determined from then on that they would send short letters to others. It's a word in season, isn't it? Apples of gold in settings of silver. Maybe just dropping by. Making a cup of tea. Ordering a pizza for somebody else. Opening up your home. Giving hospitality. Covering somebody's embarrassment. A financial gift. Maybe it's just a gift. As you know, I've had throat problems. But sometimes on returning home, waiting for me on the doorstep, has been a pot of honey. Nothing said. Nothing. No note. Just a pot of honey. Well, I can't tell you how much that kindness has meant. And that person's made an investment of time and money, and yet the impact it's had upon me has been out of all proportion to the investment that they've made. And we all know that, don't we? It's the fact that somebody noticed. I mean, people do things which are kind. They did something, didn't they? And of course, it's Christ-likeness. That's why it's so attractive. That's why it's so wonderful. Because he went about doing good. He didn't have to be asked. So time and again, he just takes the initiative. He takes control. He goes about doing good. So Christian friend, don't leave things to Mr. Somebody. I'm surprised somebody hasn't done that. I'm surprised that somebody didn't do something. Or maybe Mr. Somebody didn't notice. But you did. And if you leave it to Mr. Somebody, you'll end up with Mr. Nobody. And young people, you've got time and you've got energy. That's something which a lot of people haven't got. And maybe the cost to you of that good work will be small, but the impact it'll have upon the person you do it for will be huge. And let our people, the people of God, learn to maintain good works. Anything you can do today, anything you can do this week, eyes and ears open to opportunities. Sometimes it's good, isn't it, to ask a brother or a sister, anything I can do. And it's the sense of family, isn't it? Because as I look around, what am I seeing? I'm seeing family. I'm seeing a brother. I'm seeing a daughter. I'm seeing a mother. And their family. And I'm treating them as family, as I would treat my natural family. What can I do? How can I help? Yeah, I'll do that for you. I'll sort that out. Leave that with me. And so the family gets into the habit of good works. And the good works spread out from the life of the family further and further to the world beyond, to the glory of God. Let your light so shine before men that they may see what? Your good works. And glorify your Father in heaven. And now we come to the end of the letter. Don't forget, says Paul, I've left you with two thoughts as I've gone out the door. Don't forget. It's a long sermon, but don't forget. Verse 15. All who are with me greet you. Greet those who love us in the faith. Grace be with you all. And the you there is plural. Yes, says Paul, I know I'm writing to Titus, but actually, I'm really speaking to you all. I'm speaking to the gathered church. This is God's word to us all. Now let's go and do it. Amen.